Snow is what everyone's talking about in Kansas City right now. Well, that and football, which we'll talk about later this week. But today, snow is the topic here on KCUR's Central Standard. If you've got a story from the crazy storm we just had, we want to hear it at 816-235-2888, whether it's adventures with snowshoes or sleepovers with family or friends spent praying that your own pipes were not freezing back home. 816-235-2888. 235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman, and while you're dialing, we're going to start with one of the big issues for parents during snowstorms, school cancellations. Yesterday, with the streets mostly cleared, public school was in session on the Kansas side of the state line, but urban schools in KCMO were closed, and today we're seeing a variation on that trend with closures in Grandview, Center, Hickman Mills, and Raytown still in effect. What's that about, and how does it affect families? Angela DeWild is here with us to talk about that. She's here from Start at Zero, a kindergarten readiness program that works with parents. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the challenges that arise for families when schools call a snow day?
Yes, so families, it can cause a lot of challenges. So the first is childcare. So you know, I have a first grader and a third grader, and so you need to find a safe place for your children to be during the day. If you have to get to work, that's extremely, you know, difficult sometimes for families to figure out if they're going to lose wages or what they're going to do for their day. Also, schools provide meals, they provide warmth and structure, and some other programs for children and families that, you know, are closed that day too. So that there's a lot of challenges.
How do you see people coping with those challenges?
I think that I see, you know, families relying on each other and their friends and families and neighbors to swap childcare or find someplace safe for their children to go for the day. And I think, and unfortunately, I think that, you know, kids, you know, are left home to figure out what to do during their days. And I think that families, you know, I think they figure it out. When I knew the snowstorm was on its way, I was already thinking about Monday and Tuesday and what was going to go on with my own family.
Does it strike you as unfair that parents are subject to what can feel like the whims of their districts when it comes to decisions about canceling school or not? I mean, that seems to be like something parents are talking about right now. Why me, you know?
Right. Well, I don't envy school leaders at this time, right? Because they, you know, the roads are not clear. Buses cannot get around safely. And so I wouldn't want to be a school leader trying to decide, you know, should I go ahead and have school in session and risk the buses sliding around? Or do I, you know, cancel school, lose instructional time, put families, you know, to kind of fend for themselves those days? So I don't know. I don't envy school leaders this decision. I think it's a really difficult one. And I think families just find ways around it.
In the greater Kansas City metro, what does the lay of the land tend to be? Is there kind of a consistent pattern when it comes to who stays open and who closes?
I think any school that doesn't have to rely on bus transportation typically is open. So I know yesterday there were some charter schools that don't have buses that were able to remain open. And it was very interesting, as you mentioned, that, you know, Shawnee Mission School District was able to be open on Monday, where some of the other school districts are still closed because of power loss and other things like that. So, I think there are definitely patterns that start coming up.
Well, we've got a national guest on the line who can talk to us a little bit about the research on this, particularly how economic inequality relates to infrastructure, transportation, and therefore school closures. Andre Perry is a fellow with the Brookings Institution. Hi, Andre.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
What do you hear in this? Oh, you've got some snow, too?
Yeah, we got some snow here in D.C., and my son didn't go to school yesterday. So I feel the pain.
Well, what do you hear in this that relates to national trends when it comes to metropolitan areas and the way inequality kind of plays out?
you know, I study structural inequality, and the very definition of it can be found in differences in infrastructure. When budgets for snow removal and transportation differ, you're going to see different outcomes. And unfortunately, municipalities have different budgets and different needs, and you see that in times of stress. And so one school district, one city may close because they've dedicated monies to other things, and another may stay open. But also you see differences in differences because of income and of the parents who are in those places. Cities that have a large public transportation budgets and people who are relying on them. If those buses aren't running, kids aren't getting to school. And so the percentage of people who have cars and other forms of transportation, when it's higher in those districts, they're going to be more likely to stay open, as was mentioned. But again, we should be looking at infrastructure across counties. We shouldn't see some schools open, some schools closed, because it just creates chaos in the entire region.
When you say we shouldn't, can you tell me more about that? I mean, how is it that that does happen if it shouldn't happen?
You know, we have a long history of segregating ourselves, and that really hurts when some basic infrastructure is just not shared. Some things should be countywide, just as our pipes go across for water, go across municipalities. So should some things like snow removal and transportation, and because if it's uneven across a county or a metro, you're going to see those things played out in terms of who gets to go to school and when. You know, wealth should not be should not literally clear the path for some kids while denying others to go to school.
So this is really, like, it comes back to the snow removal question, because the transportation issue is what determines closures and openings, it sounds like, in large part. And then, yeah, the...
Well, but this is also a time for municipalities, cities, to make clear what their protocol is for closing a school. Sometimes the city is the lead. Sometimes schools make independent decisions. So these are the times for parents to really hear from city officials. What is the protocol? Do we need to change it? And also remember, snow removal budgets are generally based on 3 to 5 year averages of drop. So if you had 3 to 5 years of little snow and something hits you hard, though some places are going to have a hard time coping with those conditions.
You know,
and so a number of factors go into it.
When we talk about infrastructure, there's physical infrastructure and there's social infrastructure. So can you talk about, like, what social infrastructure is and how that's relevant to this discussion?
Yeah, social infrastructure are the places and the connections people have to them that will enable them to deal with stress. And so at this time, parents that are in places with significant social infrastructure can find ways to gather, to share child care services. They know where the one grandmother is or the grandfather is who will take in kids while parents go to work. There are places, both poor and wealthy, that have great social infrastructure. They know how to link up with one another. So again, this is a great opportunity when schools close to figure out, who do I call when I have to go to work but my son or daughter doesn't have school? Who can we work with collectively to make sure that most families are taken care of? And that varies across socioeconomic status. Now, money helps, certainly, but if you're low income and or live in a neighborhood that is low income, you almost have to be reliant on the social connections to get by. So that's very important. We got to, in particular, we should always pay attention to libraries, museums, and other common places that people often go to when schools are closed.
Angela, is this what you see in Kansas City?
Oh, definitely. I think that families, this social infrastructure, families rely on each other, you know, other school families, neighbors, like you said, the grandmother down the street. I do see this this reliance happening across income levels.
You know, I want to say I've been reading up on this, and the accepted wisdom does seem to be that closing school is bad for kids academically and also obviously hard on parents. But someone at Harvard looked into the academic piece of it, at least within his state, Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, he found that missing school for official cancellations did not affect academic outcomes the way it does when you miss school as an individual when it's still in session. So, like, it's actually better, by according to his study, academically, to cancel classes if people aren't going to be able to make it there, because then you get the makeup days and you don't get kids without access to transportation falling behind. Andre, can you talk about that? Because there is this tendency to be like closing bad, opening good. But if you're open and some kids can't make it, that has repercussions too.
Yeah. Now, again, this is where social infrastructure matters, that if you're out of school, you're still learning. Some places that the overall environment is rich enough where they're actually going to get lessons on in other ways. Sometimes it's fun and enriching to go outside and play in the snow, believe it or not. Sometimes we need those social connections for academic growth. So, yes, we want kids in school for the consistency of it, but missing a few days here and there is not going to plummet a kid's academic performance.
Andre Perry of the Brookings Institution, thank you.
You're welcome.
Angela DeWild of Start at Zero, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
When we get back from this break, we will hear how the snow is affecting you. We know you've got a story, so tell it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and everyone has a story from these snow days we've been having. You can tell yours at 816-235-2888, whether it's a power outage, epic sledding, insane cabin fever, or a crazy recipe you concocted from what you had squirreled away in your cupboard. 816-235-2888. Taylor Fort has a story about a snow woman who went missing. Taylor Fort, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
So tell me this story. How does a snow woman go missing?
Well, it was all kind of a mystery. Well, first Saturday, a friend and I, Brittany, went out to kind of have, a play snow day. Even though we're both in our late 20s, we still feel like kids. And we originally tried to make just this huge sphere. Like, I wanted to make the biggest snowball I could possibly build until I couldn't move it. And when we got to that point, we were just both struggling to move this thing.
How big was it?
It was like 5 feet tall.
Nice.
And it must have weighed like more than 100 pounds. Because even though I'm like, I only weigh 100 pounds, I'm pretty strong. So this older couple comes by. They see our struggle. And the woman comes over, introduces herself as Mary, and is like, I want to help you guys. And she's like much older than us, but has that, you know, snow brings out that childlike spirit in everybody. And she had this vision to build a snow woman, you know, a huge, voluptuous lady for the park. And we were in Gillam Park. We all live in South Central Hyde Park. And, it takes us like an hour and a half to build. And it's just beautiful. Like, she's got these seed pod eyes, like sticks for hair or leaves for hair. And, we're all very proud by the end of it.
This must have been a giant snow woman, considering that just the foundational sphere was 5 feet tall and about 100 pounds.
Yeah, it ended up being probably upwards of 6.5 or 7 feet. I guess if you counted the hair or not, that always is a debate. So yeah, a couple days pass. I show her off to a couple more friends on Sunday. And then on Monday, I'm driving around doing some errands and I like peek over to look in the park and she's gone. And I'm like, I swear that's where she was.
I just want to fast forward a second to say that you wrote a like missing snow woman bulletin, which includes a reference to her very nice scarf.
Oh, yes. She had a Mary, our new friend. Who I never got her contact info, so she's just married to me. She wrapped her scarf around her. And, the whole Snow Woman was missing, scarf included.
That is really crazy, because that's not a small object to move. Was there any evidence of, like, damage to the Snow Woman's, I'll say, to her person?
Well, not to me and the other eyewitness who first reported it to me. So that was at that point I made the Facebook post and I was like, missing 7-foot-tall snow woman, last seen in Gillen Park. And so I went around later that day because I noticed there were these tire tracks in the snow. And it occurred to me that like police work must be a lot easier when snow is falling because you can kind of see that history. And the tire tracks led from our snow woman to the location of two other really tall snow and prominent snow people in the park. And
did these snow people predate your snow person, or were they built after you made yours?
They were kind of all built around the same time. Okay. Like late afternoon on Saturday.
Gotcha. I was just wondering if maybe yours had been used to make another.
Oh, no, that would be kind of interesting.
Okay, but go on.
Sorry. So it turns out that I am imagining like a gallivanting group of young people like in their snow savvy truck had kind of blazed through the park and destroyed all the most large snow people that they could. So I happened upon a snow genocide. And when I got to the snow woman, I found but like a little piece of her head with like one of the eyes and like the hair still sticking out.
Who does this? I mean, you must have been thinking. You must be thinking about this right now. Who does this?
Well, I maybe me. Like somebody with that kind of creative spirit also has like a destructive streak to them.
And you think so?
Maybe. It probably is just as fun.
You're going to believe it's all in fun.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Because they just get melted anyway.
Well, Taylor Fort, thank you for telling me your fun snow story. Because as much as it is a hardship for people, it is also fun as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks, Gina.
Taylor has told us the story of her missing snow woman. And it is fun to play in the snow when you're available to do that, but some people are really wrestling with power outages in particular. And so we are going to talk to Gina Penzig. She's with us from KCPNL. You know, people are just really having a lot of questions about why power gets restored faster for some people than for others, or just why it's taking so long. And she is going to help us sort some of that out. Hi, Gina.
Good morning.
So obviously this can't be news to you that people like are frustrated out there. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what KCPNL's priorities are as far as like the order of restoring power when there's so much of it that's been lost.
Sure. So first of all, we appreciate that power outages are very frustrating and customers are being really patient while crews are out there working. When we have a large storm like this one, this is one of the biggest storms we've seen, winter storms in a couple of decades maybe, then the first thing we do is look at any restoration work that's needed for public safety. So that's going to be fire stations, police stations, hospitals, things, you know, entities like that that we need to get back up and get service to right away. And then we start looking at what repairs are going to have the most impact for the most people. So that usually means that we're focused on main lines that move power from the substations into the neighborhoods. then our next stage, once all those lines are repaired, is to start looking at making repairs within the neighborhood. So at that point, those main lines, maybe one repair gets power back on to 1,000 or 2,000 customers. Well, the next level, as we get into the neighborhoods, maybe each repair is getting power back on for, you know, maybe 50 to 200 or 300 customers. And then we start getting down to individual tickets where it could be anywhere from one customer to a dozen who are restored as we make those repairs. So that's how we prioritize work in a storm like this. One of the things that's been different about this storm is a lot of the outages are happening at that lower level.
At that, like, individual home or...
Yes. So individual home or neighborhood. So, you know, the job still may take a couple of hours to get done, but the number of customers being restored when you complete that work is smaller.
You know, there's a situation that seems to be very aggravating for people is when, like, they see, like, a truck roll through the neighborhood, stop for a while, and not restore their power. Can you explain what is happening?
So a couple of things could be happening here. It may be that they're making repairs to a different circuit. So circuits that feed the power to your house don't necessarily follow the same streets. People on one side of the street may be fed through a different wire than the other. So that sometimes is what happens. The other piece is we assign crews to do damage assessment. And these are folks who maybe work in operations. Sometimes it's even folks who work in accounting who we say, hey, we need your help during the storm. And they drive through the neighborhood slowly making notes of what damage they see. And this means that when the line crews finish with the main lines and move into that neighborhood, they've got the right truck, the right skills, and the right equipment they need to get work done quickly.
So that people should feel like progress is being made when they see those trucks, even though progress is not yet coming in the form of lights back on.
That's correct. So yes, there's definitely work being done to make the whole system more efficient as we work through the neighborhoods and get power restored. But it can be very disappointing to see that truck drive through and then you feel like nothing's happening for a while.
You know, there is also this question, this will be my final question, of what you guys should be taking care of and what is going to be kind of left for individuals to deal with on their own, like when it comes to fallen limbs near power lines, that kind of stuff.
Sure. So a couple of things people should take note of. First of all, there is equipment on the side of the house where the meter is attached to the home. If that's pulled away from the house and damaged, then probably they need an electrician to make those repairs before we can safely restore their power. So that's one thing to take a look at and maybe go ahead and have done. In the meantime, the other piece is storm cleanup with tree limbs and brush. Then that we are 100% focused on getting any tree limbs cleared and getting the power restored. The debris that is left behind, that's something that the homeowners will need to take care of. We'll be communicating with the community.
I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we are going to have to end our snow story segment there. Thank you for sharing, everyone. And thanks to Gina Penzig with KCPNL for fielding some of these questions. Up next, our conversation with a dean from Haskell in Lawrence. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'll be honest, I have not always been totally clear on what the dean of a college does exactly, and I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in that. But Julia Goodfox, a dean at Haskell, has made it part of her mission to let people in on the secret. She takes to Twitter with a passion, sharing what she thinks about, cares about, what she does on behalf of students at her tribal school. But she also tweets updates on Indians in the news, on Indigenous culture, issues people should be talking about. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we'll hear the story of Julia Goodfox, why she cares so deeply about tribal education, and what the conversations she starts on Twitter have to do with that. Julia Goodfox, good morning.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
You are the Dean of the College of Natural and Social Sciences at Haskell.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Love the question. I love the question. So in a nutshell, a dean helps with the day-to-day operations of a university, making sure that the doors are open, that students are earning their education, the professors are teaching. And then we're also responsible for long-term planning. Where do we see our college in the next 5 years, 10 years? And what kind of program should we be offering to our community? So it's both a day-to-day, but also being part visionary.
When you say that a dean makes sure that professors are teaching and students are getting an education, that is that's a big thing to make sure of. I mean, how do you make sure of that?
Well, with regards to our students, we want to make sure our students are having, at least at my college, what we call the Haskell experience. So we have students that are representing 140 tribes at a minimum every semester. They're coming in, and they're like college students everywhere. A lot of them are homesick. There might be some adjustments to living in Kansas. So we want to make sure at our small college that we can give them that Haskell experience. If they're having difficulty going to class, because we're so small, we're able to do a little bit more intrusive academic advising. Say, hey, how come? What's going on? What can we do to help you get into class? Doing professional advising, working with them with regards to their dreams and visions and how we can get there. And then with our faculty, we want to make sure that we hire faculty and employees that are really committed to the mission of serving Indian Country.
So when you talk about serving Indian Country and the Haskell experience, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. With regards to higher education, with our tribal colleges, a lot of people in the United States don't know that there are around 35 tribal colleges. There's one in Alaska, and the rest are in the lower 48. And so these tribal colleges, most of them are in rural areas. Haskell's an exception because we're in Lawrence, but most are in very small, isolated communities, and they offer accessible education both to American Indians and also non-tribal peoples. Haskell's an exception. We have two tribal colleges out of those 35 that only serve American Indians and Alaska Natives. And that's because of our treaty relationship with the United States.
And Haskell is one of those.
Yes, yes. So a non-tribal person can go to enroll and apply to any of the 33 tribal colleges. But for these two, Haskell and the one in Albuquerque, you have to be a citizen of an American Indian tribe.
So what drew you to Haskell? Was that part of it?
It kind of just fell into my lap. I don't mean to be flippant, but I was an undergraduate at the University of Oklahoma when I realized I wanted to work in higher education. So when I ended up at University of Kansas working on my PhD, I had heard that Haskell was looking for an adjunct in the English department. And I thought, well, I'll do this for a semester. And absolutely fell in love with it at the small college. At the time, my trajectory was to work at a state university. But that the first day I walked onto campus, it felt like home.
Why?
I suppose that because it looked like me. That might be one thing. It felt like family. Being around tribal people just felt right. And we have a significant Native American population at University of Oklahoma, but that's a large university. And of course, University of Kansas, we don't have as many American Indians or other peoples of color. And so it was really nice to go to a smaller campus, find out you can still receive a quality education, even if it doesn't have the resources that a state university does, and that people really wanted to be there. It just felt home. It felt inviting. It's a very generous campus.
You have mentioned you were originally from Oklahoma, and you're part of the Pawnee Nation?
Yes. So the Pawnee Nation is a smaller tribe. There's about 2,500 of us. At one time, we numbered over 20,000. Some of our historians say it was even higher than that. Our territory ranged from Nebraska down to Oklahoma. Around 1875, we were forced, like many tribes, into Oklahoma. And that's where we've been since then.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own experience in the education system? Because you didn't come through a tribal college yourself.
No. In fact, I'm the first generation in my family. My siblings and I are the first ones who did not go to even an American Indian boarding school. So my great-grandmother went to Indian boarding school. My grandmother and my mother.
Is that sort of part of that whole history of, I don't know, people being sort of alienated really from their own histories?
Exactly.
Through those systems.
Exactly. And so people who might not be familiar with that era of United States history, that was a period of time when the United States was working on colonization and even genocide. It does fall under definition, the UN definition of genocide, of forcibly separating children from their families, and in our case, from the tribes. So it was a way to destabilize their tribal communities. So when you think about that period of time in the late 19th century up through, let's say, World War II, all these children being separated from their families, think about the impact, the significance that had on the families and the tribes themselves. So when I was growing up, my mom would say, oh, I didn't have a mom like other people think of their mom. My mom was an institution. And I didn't understand that when I was younger. So my siblings and I were the first one who did not go to that type of boarding school. But of course, through the movements of the 1960s and 1970s, you see that these schools and these colleges become more American Indian focused. And so we get away from the colonization.
Can you explain that? Was that part of the civil rights movement?
Yes. So we can even go back into the 1950s. So people might be more familiar with African-American civil rights movements or Latino civil rights movements, women's civil rights movements during that period of time. But also American Indians were doing this as well. And we weren't as interested in civil rights as we were treaty rights. The United States has made all these treaties with American Indian nations. And we know that treaties are the law of the land according to the U.S. Constitution. So American Indians after World War II, we're starting to see if we could start having these treaty rights. So we had tribes out on the West Coast up in Washington State who started fishing, and the state was trying to prevent them from fishing on their lands. And it was very violent, very violent. There were American Indians that were shot at, that were jailed. And so you start seeing that movement there, and of course, similar to civil rights movements, it starts picking up and people start looking at how they can improve their quality of life.
And that translates to education.
Exactly.
And it sounds like turning institutions that had been used to assimilate Indians to actually be more, I don't know, communicate some kind of pride or service to that community.
Sure. I'm going to speak more about higher education and not kindergarten through 12th grade. But when you look at the history of colleges in the United States, so many we could say were almost anti-Indian. So when we have people that are in the United States government, these are college-educated people. When we look at the oil industry, these are college-educated people. And they were using their college education against Native peoples, against Indigenous peoples. And so when American Indians are going to college, still receiving that kind of colonized education that was very anti-tribal, very anti-community. So in the 1960s and 1970s is when you see the rise of the tribal college movement, and hence the 37 or 35 tribal colleges we have today. So, you know, when you attend these colleges, you're still going to learn algebra, you're still going to learn general biology, but the curriculum is going to be based on the community that it serves.
So for you, not having gone through that kind of education yourself, what does it mean to you that these students who you serve as a dean at Haskell are having such a tailored kind of experience and surrounded by people? You said that it felt like home when you walked onto this campus in a way that your previous institutions maybe had not, where
yes.
you had worked, but I'm assuming also where you studied.
That's true. That's true. And I was fortunate in a way in that I did have professors that were wonderful mentors and that were always very respectful of my particular academic journey and were also keen on learning themselves about more about the American Indian history with the United States, because it's a history that is still not taught. And so when I look at the students today at Haskell, I just feel they are so fortunate, and they'll have an experience that I will never have because I did not attend a tribal college as an undergraduate or even a graduate student. And so I just think how much further along they are in their quality of their life. And
how so, though? I wonder what you feel you did miss out on.
That's a good question. And I don't know that I've really have thought about it in depth. Even though I went to a mainstream education and went through that educational system, I think maybe what I had that perhaps others did not was I had a period of time where I had to go through a decolonial process myself. But we have to...
Wait, what do you mean by that exactly? What did it look like?
Well, when we think about from an educational standpoint, I was fortunate in that I also had a good family, good tribal members. My tribe is very politically active, very, very activist focused. So I was fortunate in that regards. But there were times where I might have assumed that there was only one way of operating, that there was only one political system that we ought to have, because maybe I did not know my own history, and that there were other ways of being a political actor, that there were other ways of having representations of ourselves in movies or TV shows or on radio shows. And so just going through that process of, because I think
so
many
you had
of
maybe
this,
kind of internalized some
yes,
of those mainstream
yes,
messages.
Yes, that was exactly what I was, yes. So, and I know that this is not only for American Indians to go through, it'd be for anybody in the U.S. Everybody in the U.S. needs to go through this and not just American Indians.
What are some of the big questions that you and your colleagues wrestle with working in academia, specifically in a tribal college setting?
Well, similar to other colleges, we're contending with what's going on right now in higher education. There are perhaps an identity issues going on as we see some of the attacks going on from our elected politician. Why have, what is the relevance of higher education? So going back and thinking about what is our role? What do we serve Lawrence? How do we serve Lawrence? How do we serve Kansas? And how do we serve Indian country, the United States, and beyond those geographical borders? So we're contending with that. What's our mission? Do we need to revisit this? And then along with other colleges, too, about funding, revenue streams, things like that.
You know, so I want to bring us back to this, the work you've been doing on Twitter. I mean, how does social media play into some of those questions that you are wrestling with? Questions about the relevance of a school like Haskell today?
Social media is one of the great inventions so far, and it really has the possibility, the potential to just broaden and open up our world. And I have learned so much from social media, and this starts from the days of MySpace, if any of our listeners remember MySpace. But people being able to connect so quickly like that, and it reminds me of when I was a child, those of you who grew up in the 70s, there was a show called Big Blue Marble, and there was that pen pal service. So social media, in a way, reminded me of that, being able to connect quickly. And my philosophy...
I do not remember this pen pal service, and I would like to know about it just briefly to understand. What you're seeing is a precursor to social media.
Yes, yes. And so on Big Blue Marble, which was one of the Saturday morning shows, there it was... a way to introduce children to films from all over the world, just short little films, and there would be U.S. actors as well. And then about halfway through the show, they would say, hey, youngsters, do you want to make a friend around the world? And so you would send in your information, and they would connect you, and you would have a pen pal. And so it was very nice to meet people that way, youngsters that way. And so when we start looking at the internet, we start looking at the early days of the philosophy behind the internet. When we're looking at these college young men, young women, college age, and those who weren't going to college, and the potential that they saw with computers and with the internet, and how they really saw a computer revolution. And we're talking back, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. And so, you know, sometimes we go off path. We saw Jack on Twitter, the CEO, who's talking about these unintended consequences. When we're looking at these idealistic ways of how the internet's going to connect us, but how did we get from that to bots and some of the other negativity that's going on? But there's I'm a firm believer in social media, and I still use Twitter to my own philosophy as an educator is to have a borderless classroom. And I that was my philosophy when I was a professor, and now as an administrator, I still believe in that borderless classroom.
Define borderless classroom.
I think that no matter what college class we're taking, no matter what the topic is, regardless of whether it's chemistry, regardless of whether it's psychology, every topic that we study, whether we're at Harvard, University of Kansas, Haskell, that class needs to be directly relevant to our communities, however we define that. And if that instructor, if that professor can't make that connection, then they probably, in my opinion, don't belong in the classroom. Education is more to me than memorizing. That to me is not education. But being able to take these facts that we need to learn and being able to apply it. So if I know what a mathematical formula is, I should also be able to apply that. And if I don't know yet, as a first-year college student, that's the job of my college professor. So when I think of borderless classrooms, I think about what we're learning, the content, the lectures, what we're teaching, and how that applies to Kansas City, how that applies to Lawrence, how that applies to Washington, D.C., or tribal peoples around the world.
So for you, social media is something that removes some of the borders from the classroom.
Yes. We see studies where they talk about there's concern about use of social media, Facebook or Twitter or other ones that younger people are using, and that it might increase rates of depression. It might increase other negative moods and feelings and behaviors. But I don't know if they're asking the right types of questions, because for other people, at least anecdotally, making those connections does increase our world.
So you did this tweet along in January where you invited your entire school community, but it actually extended beyond your school community, to join you in your day-to-day wrestling with questions as someone working in academia, as someone working to make the experience of students at a tribal college everything it can be. Why did you do that?
There were a couple of reasons. One is, as I've mentioned before, this attack that I'm starting to see on higher education in general. And I wanted to put a face to the type of work that I do. I'm not representing Haskell. I'm representing a part of Haskell. So I wanted to, what we say, demystify what the role of a dean is. This is kind of the day-to-day work that we do. And I wanted to be able to show that how accessible administration can be, regardless of whether it's Haskell or another university.
And can you tell me about maybe a conversation you were able to have by doing that you don't think would have happened in another way?
Not offhand. This is something that I plan to do like every 6 weeks or so, because I do have to find a day where that this tweet along will work. Obviously, I can't tweet during all my meetings or if there's a last minute emergency that comes up.
That might be frowned upon.
Yes. And so I'm connected with students from other tribal colleges, and also students and administrators who not only work at other tribal colleges, but colleges, particularly up north of the First Nations and in Canada. And so in a way, we're able to compare notes with each other. What's the experience up there? What's the experience down here?
Do your notes compare? What is the experience of someone at Haskell compared to someone at a tribal college in another region right now?
Well, in Lawrence, you can say that we're very fortunate in Lawrence because of the type of community that it strives to be. There are issues, as there are other places, as far as issues with police and community interactions, interactions between the communities that might identify as white with people who might identify as American Indian, African American. And the interesting thing about Lawrence, from my perspective, is that the community is willing to address those difficult conversations and have those difficult dialogues. There are places in the United States or in Canada that we might not see that as much.
You say on your Twitter profile that you are unapologetically tribal. What do you mean by that?
I love tribalism, and that might be shocking because when people hear the word tribalism, they've been taught that that's a negative word, that it's a pejorative, and which is very interesting in the United States, considering how many American Indian tribes that we have here, and considering that this is an indigenous area. And it could just be our definitions of tribalism. When I think of tribalism, I think of our, what we can call our original instructions. Every tribe has their creation story. And so we think about that and how we are adhering to our original instructions. I also think about self-determination, sovereignty, and I also think about respectful coexistence. When I think about the days ahead with regards to how climate change is going to affect our cities and affect our little towns, I think that one way that we might handle climate change is looking at how tribal communities operated in the past, how we functioned in the past. And this might be very helpful as we start thinking about our sustainability.
When you say unapologetically tribal, though, I wonder if you do feel cultural pressure to be apologetic about that.
That's another good question. And I might be a little bit more defensive just because growing up, hearing all this negativity about tribes and tribalism. And that word unapologetically comes up from a conversation I had with a CIA recruiter who came to campus. And she was talking about some work I had done in the Middle East with some doing some comparative work with tribes over there. And she was talking about Afghanistan then and how when U.S. forces go over there, they're not always, they don't understand tribes. They don't understand tribalism and really can make some problems arise. So we were talking about how to get past that. And she said, how come these tribes over there are undermining democracy or the United States? And I said, well, perhaps we could reverse the question. How come those types of forces are undermining tribalism around the world? There's no reason to.
As someone who works at Haskell, but who has worked at KU, and, you know, seeing Lawrence as a college town, but one that's most closely linked to a lot of people with that relationship with KU, the flagship state school. But Haskell is there, too, and has a presence, but one that maybe people recognize a little less in the general community. Do you think that there is some work to be done there?
There's quite a bit of work to be done there. And I can say in the nearly 15 years I've been at Haskell that Lawrence has done, is coming along in their recognition and relationship with Haskell. And we're seeing a younger generation of business owners who understand the importance of the relationship. Lawrence is very lucky to have the flagship university, but also a tribal college. Not many communities can brag about that.
Julia Goodfox visited us last March. She's a dean at Haskell Indian Nations University, where they are starting a new semester this week. And as we've mentioned, Julia is on Twitter. She's at Goodfox. If you want to keep up with her thoughts and observations, you can do it there. As you might imagine, she has some stuff to say about current references to Native American history being expressed by politicians. That's at Goodfox. That's where you can find her. If you missed this morning's conversation on Central Standard about snow and school and power outages, it'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where you'll find all of the conversations we've had on this show once they're over. And yesterday's conversation with the local artist who just got back from the border with Mexico is definitely worth a listen. Central Standard is on Twitter. just like Julia Goodfox's. We are at KCUR-CST. You can talk to us there anytime. We love to hear from you, and it's not too late to tell us your snow stories. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is coming up with Steve Kraske, so we hope you'll stick around. You don't want to miss that. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.